The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading articles to you from the Religion News Service. First of all, an article published on the 14th of March entitled Orthodox Jewish Parents Sue California for Ban on Special Ed Funds to Religious Schools by Alejandra Molina. A group of Orthodox Jewish parents of children with autism are suing the state of California, claiming it discriminates against religious students by barring private religious schools from receiving public funding for special education resources. Six parents and two private Orthodox Jewish schools in Los Angeles filed the federal lawsuit on March the 13th in the Central District of California, alleging that it's impossible for children with disabilities to attend religious schools and receive the same funding they'd otherwise be entitled to had their parents sent them to non-religious schools. Since parents often cannot afford to pay for disability services themselves, California forces them to choose between accessing those services and giving their children a Jewish education, according to the lawsuit. The Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, enacted in 1990, equips states with grants to fund special education services for students with disabilities. But in California, the lawsuit notes, only non-sectarian schools are welcome. Listed as defendants are the California Department of Education, California Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tony Thurman, and the Los Angeles Unified School District. The parents allege that California is violating their constitutional free exercise of religion rights and want the state's prohibition on funding to religious schools to be deemed unconstitutional. The funding covers speech-language pathology and audiology services, psychological services, physical and occupational therapy, as well as social work, school nursing, and counseling services, according to the suit. The legal nonprofit Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty is representing the parents. It takes a special kind of chutzpah to deny Jewish kids with disabilities equal access to special education benefits, said Eric Rosbach, vice president and senior counsel at Beckett, in a statement. California politicians can end this unlawful discrimination the easy way or the hard way. Either they change the law that is hurting children with disabilities, or they can shamefully fight in court for the right to discriminate. Beckett noted last year's Supreme Court decision that ruled Maine can't exclude religious schools from a program that offers tuition for private education in rural towns where there are no public schools. The American Civil Liberties Union, however, opposed this ruling, and with other groups such as the American Humanist Association, the Sikh Coalition, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Catholics for Choice, and the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, filed an amicus brief arguing that the inclusion of religious instruction in public school funding would knowingly coerce individuals, since they cannot entirely dictate how their tax dollars are spent. In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the ruling leads us to a place where separation of church and state becomes a constitutional violation. Beckett noted that the Orthodox Union, which describes itself as the nation's largest Orthodox Jewish umbrella organization, is supporting the effort to protect religious parents, their children, and religious schools' right to access special ed funding in the state of California. Now, an opinion piece that was published on the 13th of March, written by Nabil Tuemi, a Ph.D. Latino sociologist and educator, and senior research associate at Springtide Research Institute, entitled, Young people flourish where faith leaders see color. Do we really need to bring race into this? It's a common phrase used by those who bemoan race as a focal point of social issues in the U.S. today. This doesn't necessarily mean they're racist. Most of them are dissatisfied with the way minority racial groups are treated in America, but they are torn about whether an increased focus on race can truly make a positive difference. For those on the fence, a new study from Springtide Research Institute sheds light on the benefits of emphasizing race for America's most diverse generation to date, Gen Z. The study, called Navigating Injustice, A Closer Look at Race, Faith, and Mental Health, found that young Americans ages 13 to 25 want to talk about race and their racial identity. In fact, acknowledging one's racial identity is critical to young Black, Indigenous, people of color, known as BIPOC, thriving in their mental health, faith lives, and beyond. Identifying protective factors like open and positive conversations about race is paramount for a generation facing a mental health crisis of epidemic proportions. According to Springtide, majorities within this generation tell us they are depressed, 64% white, 61% BIPOC, or anxious, 77% white, 74% BIPOC. While 6 in 10 young people told us, the adults in my life don't truly know how much I'm struggling with my mental health. At the same time, Gen Z is finding relief through spirituality. Despite the popular narrative that Gen Z is the least religious generation yet, majorities of Gen Z tell us they're flourishing in their faith lives, 57% white, 65% BIPOC, and that their faith matters for their mental health, 52% white, 58% BIPOC. For young people of color, the realization of a mentally and spiritually healthy life depends in part on whether their identities are acknowledged and celebrated, rather than dismissed or downplayed, within America's 350,000-plus faith communities. I am the person who can't leave race outside of a space. Being Black shapes the way I think about things in a lot of ways, and what I tend to think about. Religious or spiritual places are no exception. May, age 20, told researchers. Living in a way that is aligned with one's racial and spiritual identity imbues young BIPOC's lives with meaning, purpose, and direction, all things that positively contribute to flourishing and mental health. Studies show that young BIPOC who take pride in their racial identity are more likely to report peer acceptance, interpersonal functioning, and belonging within their communities. Further, many young BIPOC experience their racial identity as a spiritual gift, helping to illuminate and direct the divine's purpose for their lives. Caleb, age 22, shared, "I could have been born a white man. I could have been born a Hispanic girl. But I am African. I'm a Black man. There's a reason for that. God can use me in this way. He has designed me to go to certain spaces where other people can't go." In short, for young BIPOC, race and religion are not separate, but intertwined. Accordingly, young BIPOC told researchers how difficult it can be to belong to organizations or communities that do not celebrate, let alone acknowledge, their racial identity. Lauren, age 15, an Asian American, explained, "Race is what makes you, you. So if your religion wants to separate race, if they're not making you want to embrace your ethnicity, I feel they haven't really seen you for who you are." By contrast, young BIPOC claim to flourish when they are part of organizations that honor their racial and ethnic identities. Isabella, age 23, said, "My faith community brought me a lot of confidence and less anxiety regarding who I am and where I came from. So they influenced me in a positive way by honoring my culture, my identity. Understanding my identity just takes all of the pressure off, you know? I was more proud to be Latino. I didn't feel inferior. So, yeah, I just love who I am, and I love where I come from. My faith community has given me the confidence that I belong in this community and with Christ. Talking about race in the U.S. today can be fraught, no doubt. But these stories from members of Gen Z suggest having these difficult conversations is worth it. When we as a community express curiosity about racial identity, we acknowledge and celebrate young BIPOC's spiritual identity as well. We help young BIPOC, who report record levels of loneliness, feel valued and seen. The stakes for leaning into topics that concern Gen Z have never been higher. Let's bring race into the conversation by asking young people of all races and ethnicities to reflect on how their identities create meaning and purpose in their lives. These conversations should seek to empower young people to claim their identities with dignity and pride, and to see them as one part of the wholeness of their personhood. Young people don't leave their racial identity at the door when they walk into places of worship, and they don't want to. If you ask young people to leave race at home, you might as well tell them to stay home, too. Now, an article published on the 16th of March in the Religion News Service entitled City of Faith Exhibit Celebrates South Asian Religion in New York City by Catherine Post, New York. In 2012, Erica Menendez shoved Sunando Sen, 46, onto the New York City subway tracks in front of an oncoming train. I pushed a Muslim off the train tracks because I hate Hindus and Muslims ever since 2001 when they put the Twin Towers down. I've been beating them up, she is quoted as having told police shortly after the fatal crime. Sen was born in India and raised Hindu. In popular culture, New York City is often portrayed as distinctly secular, but City of Faith, Religion, Activism, and Urban Space, a new exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York, suggests that the city and the public spaces, scents, acts of solidarity, and yes, the hate crimes therein, can't be understood without religion. I think religion is a subtext in the various spaces and conversations where we imagined it to be absent, the exhibition's curator, Azra DeWood, told RNS in a recent interview. And I'm really hoping that the exhibition surfaces some of the ways in which religion is actually a part of the city. With a collection of original portraits, maps, and interactive installations featuring curated scents and soundtracks, DeWood challenges New York's non-religious reputation, arguing that the city's perceived secularism is really covert Protestantism. Against this backdrop, in which Protestantism dominates via land, money, and politics, and Catholic and Jewish communities have made inroads, South Asian communities can become both indistinguishable and hyper-visible. As a Muslim and South Asian woman, DeWood is personally familiar with this dynamic, and as an architectural historian, she often considers how religion shows up in concrete and visible ways. Religion is not siloed off in explicitly religious institutions, such as churches, synagogues, temples, mosques, DeWood observed. You find it in the city's shared public spaces, on streets and sidewalks and waterways, foodways. DeWood pointed to Johann Eisel's photo of a man praying next to a halal food cart in Midtown Manhattan as an example of unexpected religion featured in the exhibit. The halal food carts began as a way of providing cheap halal food to Muslim communities working in different kinds of businesses, she said. Now it's a gastronomic delight for all New Yorkers. Photographs displayed throughout the exhibit highlight how minority religious communities refuse to be boxed in by stereotypes. Photographed portraits by MIP Stirs, a Muslim arts and culture collective, show Muslims grinning and striking poses in New York's public landscape to reclaim the space. Portraits of New York-based Sikhs by Amit Amin and Narup Udi celebrate people as former New York City subway operator Sathari Singh. Singh, who saved 800 lives by reversing his train during 9/11, also successfully sued the Metropolitan Transportation Authority after it required employees to brand their religious headgear with MTA logos. These images provide a counterpoint to reductionist narratives. While majority religions have the luxury of blending into a cultural landscape, the exhibit suggests that Sikh, Hindu, and Muslim groups don't have that privilege. The flattening and racialized profiling of these communities is captured in the installation Curb, a sprawling book of poems encased in glass and placed in the center of one of the exhibit's two rooms. The poems explore violence against South Asian Americans in the U.S. public spaces and are presented alongside two short films inspired by the poems. Poet Divya Victor, who was also an advisor on the exhibit, describes her poems as emerging from the long wake of the Patriot Act, the era of the Muslim Registry, and the Trump administration's anti-immigrant policies. I knew that poets and writers would need to begin paying special attention to surveillance, spectatorship, supremacist vigilance, and monetized police public confession, she told RNS. I also knew that I needed to document the fear that my family members began to experience in public spaces with the rise of anti-immigrant and especially anti-Asian acts. Victor added that the poems, which are now available in paperback, also reflect the resistance to both white and Hindu supremacist forces taking root in South Asian communities. Though the exhibit largely focuses on them moments of beauty and solidarity among South Asian communities, it doesn't shy away from grappling with the fraught realities of anti-blackness and the legacy of the caste system. South Asian artist Utsa Hazarika Pilgrim's This Is Not That Dawn, for instance, is a commissioned multimedia piece that explores the complex relationship between Black and South Asian communities in America. Beneath a large stylized image of a stamp from India depicting Martin Luther King Jr., museum goers are invited to put on headphones and hear the soundtrack Hazarika designated. Listeners overhear Martin Luther King Jr. reflect on the encounter with the caste system during his 1959 trip to India and are reminded by comedian Hassan Minhaj of how the civil rights movement paved the way for the growth of South Asian communities in the U.S. The only reason so many of us are here is because of the Immigration Act of 65. That law rode the wave of the Civil Rights Act of 64, Minhaj says in the soundtrack. The exchanges between American civil rights activists and the anti-colonial movement in South Asia mark a period of internationalism that has largely fallen away from mainstream consciousness, Hazarika told RNS. In the United States specifically, the potential of these movements has been obscured by both a loss of this internationalist history and the racial structure within which South Asians have often tended toward a proximity to whiteness, rather than embracing their anti-colonial histories to oppose radicalized violence. Other installations, such as the bold colored portraits of South Asian American feminist activists by artist and South Asian Women's Creative Collective founder, Jayshree Abhichandani, also uplift examples of South Asian activism both within and beyond cultural and religious circles. Though New York is filled with the art, architecture, collective action, and history of South Asian communities, this is the first exhibit at the century-old Museum of the City of New York to focus on them, according to DeWood. She hopes this exhibit, which closes in October, will prompt people to recognize the vibrant religious expressions of South Asian groups and to observe the subtle way religion operates in the world around them. It is often really difficult to talk about religion, DeWood said. I hope the exhibition shows how multi-layered the conversation about religion is and how much it's part of our landscape. Our final article was published on the 15th of March in the Religion News Service and written by Jana Rice, entitled All Aboard the Mormon Women's History Cruise. Cruising is one of my favorite kinds of vacation. Cruising to the Bahamas with women who are interested in Mormon history? That's basically a dream come true for me. So the same day I learned about such a cruise was scheduled to happen in July, I signed up. I also talked with two of the organizers, historians Lori Maffley Kipp and Carrie Ann DeLoach. Both have been part of a multi-year women's history consultation run by the Neil A. Maxwell Institute at Brigham Young University. But when the funding for that group ended, they found they still wanted to continue meeting, hence the cruise, which they are opening up to other women beyond their core group. The prices are reasonable, starting at $627 for a four-day cruise on Royal Caribbean's Independence of the Seas, including a shared inside cabin and meals on the ship. My interview has been edited for length and clarity. So why a cruise? DeLoach. In academia, we have traditional ways to fund things, grant applications and institutional support. Those things take a lot of time. They're also unreliable. I'm an entrepreneur. I own a vintage clothing wholesale distribution company, in addition to being a scholar. So as we thought about fundraising, I was looking for ways to capitalize that could use our expertise and also provide other women, maybe non-scholars, with the same type of atmosphere and connection and sisterhood that we have. I am partially disabled because of a military injury. I love cruising. That's the only kind of family vacation we take because it's accessible for me. So I just thought, I don't think anybody's taking just women to learn about Mormon women's topics in this kind of environment, where we don't have to cook, and we don't have to worry about where we go, and we don't have to worry about where we sleep, and we don't have to clean up after ourselves. So let's do it. Maffley Kipp, part of our goal is to be able to talk about Mormon women's history to people who are not professional academics at all. There's so much to share, and so many interesting ways of looking at this that we feel would be a benefit to all kinds of different women, not just keeping it in university settings. DeLoach, yes, the speakers are always going to be scholars who are experts in their fields. I just don't think that there's another opportunity for everyday Mormon women to have that type of one-on-one access like we're offering. We're going to eat meals together and worship together and go on shore excursions together and hang out together. Hopefully, the retreat will create lasting relationships and disseminate knowledge to a more diverse group. What will the workshops be like? Maffley Kipp, I'm talking about global moral Mormon women, the LDS Church around the world. Amy Hoyt, one of the organizers, is talking about sisterhood, and she and I are doing a shore excursion together at an extra cost. DeLoach, my talk is going to be on fashion and Mormonism and modesty between the 1920s and the 1960s, and I'll bring some examples. We run a private archive of about 7,000 pieces of clothing. Mathley Kipp, just to be clear, all of the activities are voluntary. It's a vacation. So if you don't want to go to all the talks, you just hang out with some interesting women on a boat, you can do that too. How many people are coming with us? Deloach, we have space for up to 80 women. Since it's our first year, I think Royal Caribbean wasn't sure there would be enough interest. They were like, do you think Mormon women really want to do this? And I'm like, I'm positive. Mathley Kipp, my motto for this is to prove Carrie Ann right by coming on this cruise, showing that there is an audience for this. There are other kinds of gatherings for Mormon women, like Time Out for Women, which is one day. But this is 4 days. This is fabulous. It's an extended time out. Our hope is that it's successful enough that we could do a larger group next time, and also that we can change our destinations. I think there's a lot of interest in a UK experience because we have such a rich history of female missionaries also going to the UK. There's some really great itineraries that hit the UK and Ireland that I think would be fantastic. We didn't want to take such a bold and aggressive step our first year because European airfare is quite expensive. But there's also fantastic things closer to home, like Mississippi River cruises and the Northwest Passage cruises and Hawaii. I mean, Hawaii. Oh my God. Do you have to be Mormon to come? Mathley Kipp, you do not have to be a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. One of the wonderful things about the initial group that met is that it was made up of some women like Carrie Ann who were church members, some like me who had never been church members, and other women who had been in church but were questioning things. So there will be all manner of approaches. Deloach, we're not endorsed by the church, but I don't think anything is going to happen there that would upset the church. And it doesn't matter what stage of life you're in, married, single, retired, no kids, college kids, baby kids. I think it's very hard for women, particularly LDS women, to find time for themselves. And it's so important to find time for intellectual growth. It makes us better at everything that we're doing. On this cruise, you get to learn and to relax. I'm particularly excited about the food. I love when I don't have to cook. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.